This episode of Local Knowledge is presented by Olokai. Olokai, our favorite Hawaiian-inspired sandal brand, is now making golf shoes. And I own a pair of these golf shoes, by the way, the Menil brand in the color Trench Blue. And I would encourage you to go look them up because I'm not really a huge shoe guy. Even I can tell these are gorgeous shoes. More importantly for me, they're very light, they're very comfortable, they have great traction, and I shot my best round ever with them. I don't know if it was 100% the shoes, it may have been a little bit me, but the shoes really are terrific. So bring the aloha spirit to your course. With every step, you'll feel like you're walking along the beaches in Hawaii. Spikeless construction offers great traction and comfort on the course, and Olokai golf shoes transition easily to off the course wear too. They have sporty and classic styles for both men and women. So check them out at olokai.com. That is olukai.com. Again, the trench blue in the Menil style. That's my personal recommendation. And you can use code DIGEST for free expedited shipping.
Sam Snead, winner of the British Open Championship, the Masters, the PGA. Ryder Cup player over two decades and frequent Canada Cup representative.
On June 16, 1940, Sam Snead played in a tournament called the Inverness Invitational Four-Ball in Toledo, Ohio at the Inverness Club. This was a strange little event. There were eight teams, so 16 players total, and it was round robin. So every team played every other team in an 18-hole match, and you gained a point for each hole you won. You lost a point for each hole you lost. This is all contested over 126 holes. And the team with the most points was declared the winner. Very kind of convoluted, but hopefully you get it. Snead and Ralph Goldall, his partner, won that year. Snead won again in 1950, and he won again in 1952. And in 1952, that time, there were only six teams. Let's go a few years earlier, in July of 1936. Snead won something called the West Virginia Closed Pro. Now, what is that? That's a harder question to answer than you might think. Historians later had to go back and sort through a lot of misinformation. The name of the tournament itself was up for debate. Some thought it was actually in Virginia, not West Virginia. There was an alleged photo of it that they were relying on, but that turned out to be of an exhibition at the Greenbrier. Finally, in 2010, a newspaper out of Charleston figured out what this was. It was at the Greenbrier. It was run simultaneously with the West Virginia Amateur. And what closed pro meant was that this was essentially a different flight in this tournament, but just for pros. It was held in one day, 36 holes, and Snead's nearest competition was a man named Clem Weichman, who he beat by 16 shots. And Clem Weichman was a local club pro. In fact, all of Snead's opponents that day were local club pros. Even the tour pros from the area seemed not to have entered the event. Five times, Sam Snead won a tournament called the Palm Beach Round Robin, which was an invitational. The format is too complicated to go fully into, and that's by the standard of the previous one I described, so imagine how messed up this one is. But this was a field of 16 players. He won that five times. In 1937, he won the Bing Crosby Pro-Am. That was 18 holes that year, a single round. He won it again in 38 and 41. It was 36 holes in those years. And when he won again in 1950, it was 54 holes by then, but he tied four other guys, and because of their travel requirements, they couldn't do a playoff. In 1946, Sam Snead won the World Championship of Golf, which even at the time was called an exhibition. It was 36 holes, and he won that against three other players. So why am I telling you all this? What's the thread that ties it all together? Well, you may know that Sam Snead, great player that he was, is currently tied with Tiger Woods for the most PGA Tour wins in history, 82. Those tournaments I just described to you, that totals 14 wins with everything I just went through. And this is a key point here. Every single one of those wins counts as a PGA Tour victory for Sam Snead. Single day events, three opponents, you know, team events with very limited fields. Now, if that sounds absurd to you, as it does to me, I want you to consider a few other things. First off, many of these tournaments were not considered official PGA Tour events when they were held. So why are they now? We'll get there. Second, and this is very important because we're going to compare Snead and Tiger Woods, you simply cannot find the equivalent in the resume and the record of Tiger Woods. Tiger won things like the PGA Grand Slam. That was a four-player event. He's won World Cups. Limited Field, the Target World Challenge, the Chevron World Challenge. He's won multiple European Tour events. None of those count to his 82. Not one of them. If you look at his 82 wins, you simply cannot argue with a single one. They are all legitimate PGA Tour events. And the third thing I want you to consider, and this is in some ways the best and worst part of all this, but you know who was most upset at Sam Snead having 82 wins? Before he died in 2002, it was Sam Snead himself. He thought he'd been cheated. By his own reckoning, he thought he should have 89. And it bothered him, according to multiple witnesses, throughout his life and right up until the end. So this episode that we're doing here of Local Knowledge is a little bit different from most. Normally we tell some kind of story, whether it's historical or contemporary, has a beginning, middle, and end. There's some of that here too. But what's unique this time is that I'm taking a position, staking out a place in the realm of opinion, and I don't want to hide that or pretend that I'm neutral on this question. I think, on one hand, I think it's ridiculous that Snead is credited with 82 wins. And it goes without saying, by the way, that this is not Sam Snead's fault. He was a great player and he deserves a ton of respect. This is a question of numbers. And if we're calling into question institutions and the decisions they made, don't let that be misconstrued as a knock on Snead. It's a numbers question, not a human being question. But for the record, because people will take it as disrespect, let us acknowledge up top that Snead was superlative in every way you can measure. He had talent, obviously, a knack for winning. He won 7 majors. The only one he didn't win was the U.S. Open. He was kind of Phil-like in that way. The U.S. Open always eluded him. He had 12 top 10s, 4 runners-up there. But he won everything else, and above all, he had longevity. His first acknowledged PGA Tour win was in 1936. His last was in 1965. That's almost 30 years. So there's your disclaimer on Snead. We probably didn't need it, but it's good to get it out there. Because the rest of this is going to be making the argument that Tiger Woods is really getting the short end of the stick here, that his 82 wins are far more impressive, far more legitimate than Snead's, and that, in fact, Snead's total should be nowhere near 82. Should be closer probably to 70 or even below that. He should probably be below Jack Nicklaus for what that's worth. And this whole argument as recently as 2013 didn't really seem to matter in the greater golf world. You know, Tiger won the Bridgestone Invitational that year. It was his 79th official PGA Tour victory. For all intents and purposes, it was a no-brainer that he was going to break the record. And all the arguments about Snead's achievements, they're a minor quibble and a historical footnote. Who cares? Well, we know what happened. Tiger went through some really tough times. Came back and he won the 2018 Tour Championship. That was number 80. He, of course, won the 2019 Masters. That was 81. And that year, he also won the Zozo Championship. So that gives him 82. And that's where he stopped. Life is funny, isn't it? We have this arbitrary, questionable decision-making that gives Sam Snead 82 wins. This is before Tiger's career even begins. And what do you know? That's exactly where Tiger lands when it's all said and done. Or maybe not all said and done. Okay, Tiger's story is not over, and I have personally been burned before by underestimating what he can do. But he is 48 years old, his body does not seem to be holding up, and it appears that he's mostly, in the future, going to be playing majors or other really big events, but not many of them, against incredibly tough fields. In other words, it is looking unlikely, and I think it's being not generous, but it's being safe. It's looking unlikely that he'll ever win again. Which creates a situation that I don't think Tiger really cares that much about, actually. But in terms of golf legacy and golf history, it matters that he's now tied with Sam Snead. They're deadlocked. And that might be forever. And the point I want to make here, put as simply as I can put it, is that they shouldn't be tied. And if we care about a legitimate reflection of all-time wins on the PGA Tour, somebody with some power should probably do something about this. There is nothing like the anticipation of your next golf trip. So wouldn't it be nice to have a credit card that helps you feel on top of your travel game? Whether you aim to tee off on a course across the country or follow the pros around the globe, the City Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard elevates your travels. It's the only card with American Airlines Admirals Club membership, allowing you to start each trip in comfort. You'll also enjoy your first check bag free on domestic American Airlines flights, so your clubs are always with you, from Miami to Scottsdale. and every purchase earns American Airlines Advantage miles towards your next trip and loyalty points toward Advantage status. You can even earn up to 20,000 additional loyalty points after qualifying activities. Enhance your travels with the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard. Apply today at citi.com/executive to earn 70,000 Advantage bonus miles after qualifying purchases, and then look forward to your next adventure. Citi Advantage. Travel on. Standard checked baggage weight conditions apply. I'm Shane Ryan. This is Local Knowledge. And the first person I want to recognize in terms of those who helped us out is somebody who prefers to be referred to just by his Twitter name, which is Robops. And we had a conversation on Twitter and we had a conversation on the phone as well. And this is one of those guys who just has a serious interest in this stuff. He spent about a year of his life compiling data about fields, about winds. You know, he used newspapers.com to get into Snead's record. He looked into USGA archives. He did an incredible amount of research all on his own. And it's unbelievably helpful. And it's one of those refreshing stories where you think, I'm very glad someone out there did this. I'm glad this guy exists. And he also, in the process, answered one of the tough questions of this debate between Tiger and Snead, which is, where do you draw the line as to what constitutes a PGA Tour event? With Tiger, it's much easier, because in the modern era, everything is very clearly defined and delineated, but with Snead, it's not so easy. You could just say, well, what did the PGA Tour think was an actual event when he played? But the problem is, as we're going to discuss later on, the people who made the choice about how many victories Snead had, and they did this in the 1980s, long after his career was over, they didn't abide by that standard. If they had, Tiger would already be winning. It wouldn't be a discussion. This was a committee who made these decisions. And let's put that on pause for a moment, because again, we're going to get into it. Except to say that what they did obliterated any chance for clear definitions. So the Twitter user Robops, after he compiled all his information, what he had to do was say, okay, what is our standard here? How am I comparing these guys? And I can't just do it based on what the tour said, because that's out of the water. And I thought his solution was brilliant. And he made a chart, and I'm going to retweet the comparative chart he made. You know, we're limited by the audio medium of a podcast here, but it's worth looking at if you can get to see it. So if you want to check it out yourself, come to my timeline, Shane Ryan here, and you'll see his name. I'll retweet him. You'll see his name pop up. You can follow him, and you're going to see this infographic he made. But the standard he established for differentiating these wins, let's use that term, was something he called a 20-quality player or 20-quality team minimum. And that means exactly what it sounds like. And he goes into the standards and his criteria on the graphic, but let's summarize them here. There are five basic criteria that have to be met in order to be included on his list of that 20 quality player minimum, 20 team minimum. First is, obviously, you have to have 20 legitimate tour level players or teams in the case of a team event. And they have to be from the PGA Tour, European Tour, or, you know, earlier versions of European circuits. And how he defines that is either you won on one of these tours, or you've been playing full-time for at least 5 years. Now, imagine how much of a grind that research had to be. Like I said, I'm glad someone out there is doing the hard work. Second piece of criteria, the event has to be at least 3 rounds, or 2 rounds minimum if it's weather-shortened. Third, there has to be a purse commensurate with the contemporary standard. Fourth, if there's a team event, you need 20 teams at least with quality players, as we said. And fifth is kind of specific to cup competitions. Basically, it says, you know, individual wins can be counted, but not team wins if there's a certain way that those cups work. Not super important. So I think, you know, the point I want to make about these criteria, not only is it sensible, but it's also leaning on the side of inclusion, right? It's saying that all you need here is 20 quality players. And, you know, a tournament that's 2 rounds long or 3 rounds long, It's not cutting Snead off arbitrarily. It's not taking these tournaments and making it more difficult for him. I think it's allowing more, maybe even than it should, but I like that nice, conservative, lenient standard because, in a way, it makes the argument for Tiger Woods stronger. So, by using these standards, Robops, he finds out how many players each tournament has won that qualify. And for Tiger, he's won 92 events that meet this standard. 10 of those are European Tour events, hence his total in the PGA Tour of 82. For Snead, he only wins 76 tournaments that meet these standards. And also, Robops includes Jack Nicklaus. Nicklaus actually has 77 of them, so he has one more than Snead. But then below that, on the second page for each player, he lists events that they won that didn't qualify, that they won in their lifetimes. Tiger has 16 of those. We mentioned some of them earlier, the World Cups, the World Challenge, the Target World Challenge, the Grand Slam. Nicklaus has 20. Snead has 30. And what Robops does, which is so great, is that he color codes all of these on both halves, the first page, the second page, so that you can see which ones among these wins are counted as PGA Tour wins officially. Now, in Tiger's list of events that meet this 20-player criteria, we said there's 92, 10 of them don't qualify, they're European, so he has 82 wins, easy peasy. And if you look at his non-qualifying wins by the standards of Robops, the 16 of them, none of them are counted for the PGA Tour. So what that means is, you know, long story short, he's not getting any cheap wins. Now, Snead has these 76 qualifying wins that meet the minimum of 20 actual players. 10 of those aren't tour wins officially for various reasons, just like Tiger, which reduces him to 66. So how do you get to 82 for him? Because you go on page 2 and those cheap wins of the 30 that he's credited with, 16 of them are counted as PGA Tour wins. That's 16 cheap wins, the non-qualifying kind. You know, all the ones we mentioned at the start of the podcast, the 14 with the Inverness four ball and all that stuff, plus a couple more without a strong enough field to qualify. And they'll all get added to that total. And that, to me, if you look at this chart, and hopefully I'm explaining it well, hopefully you're not getting lost in the weeds, it is the clearest possible look at the comparison between the two, and it's not close. Tiger has exceeded Sam Snead by a lot, if we're playing fair. And by the way, another cool thing Robops does is he puts a little symbol, a little percentage sign in front of any win that was not a PGA Tour event at the time, but is now retroactively considered an official PGA Tour win. Tiger has 0 of these. Jack Nicklaus has 0 of these. Sam Snead has 13. Plus 3 more that may have been unofficial. He couldn't really figure it out. Some of this stuff is lost in the fog of history. So these wins we keep talking about, the cheapies with Snead, and I made the point above, but I want to make it again, they weren't considered legitimate at the time. Which brings us to the big question, why are they considered legitimate now? What happened? And I find this part fascinating because it is all about human judgment and the fallibility of that judgment. What happens when you give certain people a little too much leeway in how to interpret history, and, in my opinion, what happens when they blow it? Now, for this, we have a great resource in a piece written by Lori Livesey, who is a PGA Tour historian, and on PGAtour.com in 2019, after Tiger won the Masters, but before he won the Zozo, so when he was at 81 wins, just one shy of Sam Snead, Livesey wrote a piece called How We Got to 82. Now, from a historical perspective, Livesey does an amazing job telling us exactly why Snead is credited with his 82 wins. It's very thorough, very well-documented. You know, if you're obsessive and you like to know each thing, Livesey will give you every single detail, and it's great. From a critical perspective, he is treating it with kid gloves to some extent, which is to be expected, right? This is written from the PGA Tour side of things. They were the ones who did this, or had a big hand in doing it at least. So he doesn't come guns blazing, but to Livesey's credit, he doesn't try to hide the arguments against some of these wins by Snead. He was never maybe going to be adamant that they shouldn't count, but he's not whitewashing it either, and you have to respect that. And what Livesey writes is that during Snead's playing career, and remember, probably should have mentioned this earlier, but this is before the PGA Tour breakaway in 1968, so things are run by the PGA of America at this time. The PGA Tour as we know it today doesn't quite exist. There is still a circuit, and this is, you know, the events are still official or not official and all that. It's not quite the same thing, but we, you know, we kind of count it as the same thing for history. Anyway, during Snead's playing career, the PGA of America sits down with him, and in their attempt to keep an accurate record, which was spotty at best to that point, they sat down and they went over his wins with him, basically asking him, you know, tell us everything you won, because we need to fix the record here. And when we talk about this stuff, we are, again, I used this phrase before, we're very much in the fog of history. It's not like it is today. Nothing is quite as cut and dry. It's all more loosely connected. And when you're trying to figure out wins like this, there is no easy archive. So that's why they sat down with Snead, and he pretty much just told them what he had won. And so after this, and they did this with a lot of players, not just Snead, the official PGA tournament record book comes out, and lo and behold, Snead's first victory is listed as the Virginia Closed Pro, which was actually the West Virginia Closed Pro, remember? Which is actually not an official event, but Snead said it was, and there was, you know, romance around him having won the first one of his career. He talked it up, so there you go, it's in the books. And then when 1968 comes around, there's the big schism, the breakaway, and we have a more official PGA Tour, the one we know today. They just adopt the PGA of America's record books, which is to be expected, right? It's the simplest thing to do. It's a resource that exists. Why would it be wrong? They adopt them. And so that becomes part of their historical record, too. There is nothing like the anticipation of your next golf trip. So wouldn't it be nice to have a credit card that helps you feel on top of your travel game? Whether you aim to tee off on a course across the country or follow the pros around the globe, the City Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard elevates your travels. It's the only card with American Airlines Admirals Club membership, allowing you to start each trip in comfort. You'll also enjoy your first check bag free on domestic American Airlines flights, so your clubs are always with you, from Miami to Scottsdale. And every purchase earns American Airlines Advantage miles towards your next trip and loyalty points toward Advantage status. You can even earn up to 20,000 additional loyalty points after qualifying activities. Enhance your travels with the City Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard. Apply today at city.com/executive to earn 70,000 Advantage bonus miles after qualifying purchases, and then look forward to your next adventure. City Advantage. Travel on. Standard check baggage weight conditions apply. So what happens next? Well, what happens next is nothing for a long time, but even when nothing's happening, something is happening. And I know that sounds very strange, but the thing that's happening in this period of stasis where nothing changes is that these things gather weight just with the passage of time. And contributing to this, as Livesey writes, is the fact that, let's take the West Virginia Closed Open. Again, it's Snead's first win. There is historical import there. The older Snead gets and the longer the tour exists, it becomes more historically important. Snead himself romanticizes it. It becomes part of golf lore, and that's kind of hard to get rid of. Remember, this is a small tournament in West Virginia where he only beat local club pros and he demolished them. There's no way, objectively, that this ever should be remotely thought of as a PGA Tour official event. But history is not objective here. Same for all of the other tournaments. These exhibitions with three other golfers that were never considered official, they get lumped in. You know, the team events, the round robins, a lot of this stuff gets lumped in. And his total on the PGA Tour record books up until the mid-80s is 84, not 82. But this is crucial. There comes a point when there is an opportunity for the tour to correct this. And to some extent, they must see the need for it. So it starts in 1986. When the tour, under Dean Beeman, puts together this panel that includes journalists, staffers. Their job is to compile tournament data from 1934 to 1979. The idea is to set the record straight here. And the goal, the final goal, the eventual goal, is that they were going to rank players and say, who's the best ever? And there was going to be a book as well. And that book did come out. It's called The History of the PGA Tour by Al Barkow. It eventually comes out in 1989. So this initial panel, we'll call them Panel 1, they do a lot of this work, and then in 1987, Beeman gets a second panel together, call it Panel 2, to make the tough calls about what is going to count and what won't. So Panel 1 has the data, Panel 2 comes together, they're the decision makers. And they're not just deciding for Snead, they're deciding for everybody. And this panel has Al Barkow, who's going to write the book, Herbert Warren Wynn, the famous journalist who coined the term Amen Corner, among other things. He wrote for The New Yorker, he's on it. Joe Dye, the former USGA head, the former PGA Tour first commissioner, Joe Black, a former president of the PGA of America, and various other people, tour staffers and folks like that. There's nine of them, and they meet at Augusta in 1987, the Tuesday before the Masters, and they make all these decisions in one afternoon. What's an official win? What's not official? What counts? What doesn't? This is all hashed out in a couple hours. Now, if that sounds like a bad idea to you, to do everything, you know, something that this historically important, just in one afternoon, well, the criteria for deciding is even worse, because it's not something like our friend Robops on Twitter did, where he looked at objective criteria like field size and quality, and it's also not what was considered official contemporaneously. We know that, right? Instead, as Livesey writes, here's what happens. Quote, "The main takeaway from the meeting was that the panel amended the unofficial tournament list from the previous group's determinations and changed the record to include tournaments of, quote, historic significance." That was key verbiage, end quote. Yes, key verbiage indeed. And when they talk about the previous group, that's panel one, right, from the year before, that seems to have done the real research here, and may have included some of the same people. We don't know much about them. But again, they seem to have done the real work. And then these guys come in panel two, and with this historical significance tag, they make it completely subjective. They give themselves power to just decide in a couple hours which are official, which are not. And it has very little connection with reality. It's only connected to their opinions. And you can decide for yourself how much this actually matters. Maybe we're making a mountain out of a molehill here. But if it does matter to you, this is like manhandling history. It's like if an episode of Around the Horn on ESPN got to decide when the World Series actually started. You know, they say, oh, actually, it's 1934. There were no World Series before then. It's absurd. And this is where, obviously, I'm getting opinionated. I warned you it would happen. But this makes no sense to me. Now, here's what Livesey writes. Quote, "In defense of the process, which was admittedly light on time spent, this was no easy assignment, and the final decision meant it was impossible to satisfy everybody, even if the panel, as Becca explained," interjecting here to say Becca is a tour official who is part of that panel, "went in with no preconceived ideas and made judgment calls based on the available data. We had a job to do and we did it. We did what we thought was right," Becca explained. End quote. And that's kind of what I mean when I say, you know, Livesey gives it the light touch. He's not going to outright crucify these guys. You know, he's writing from inside the walls. That's fine. So what's the result of this? These guys having carte blanche to decide what is historically significant, even if it's not connected to any real standard. Well, the result is the Bing Crosby Pro-Ams are counted. Those are historically significant. Even if one of them was 18 holes, even if others were 36 holes, even if one of them was a tie, that gives Snead five extra wins. They count the Palm Beach round robin wins, all five of those. They count that West Virginia Open still, because of course it's still his first win. You can't get rid of it. It's almost too big to fail at this point or something like that. So it must be historically significant, right? Now, interestingly, they do take away his wins at the Greenbrier Invitational, and there were five of those. In fact, at the time when he was playing, there was some tension between Snead and the PGA of America because he was kind of doing his own thing here. In fact, he, you know, his name got attached to the title of the tournament eventually. So they dock a couple of those. They dock a couple of others, including one tournament he didn't actually win, but had been on the record books. He might have told them, you know, inadvertently that he had won it. That was being perpetuated for a long time. It was something in Texas. Didn't actually win it. So the actual effect of all this, which is funny in its way, is that Snead drops from 84 wins to 81. His final total of 82 came later when they retroactively gave him credit for the Open Championship at St. Andrews. It's funny that, you know, again, there's comical elements of this. They're giving him, you know, Palm Beach round robin wins, but the Open Championship, no, we're not going to give that to you. They eventually did later. But again, the headline of all of this is he goes down from 84 to 81, but what that misses is that they had a chance to really define what an official win is and to end the farce of these round robins, of the Inverness tournaments, the Bing Crosby, all of this stuff, the West Virginia Open. They could have wiped it all off the map, and they didn't. They missed their chance. But the amazing thing about all this is Snead was upset, and he stayed upset. His son remembers him saying, you know, they took those wins away from me. And this is even though he was ranked number one in this project. When they did the player rankings, they put him ahead of Jack Nicklaus. And he's mad, even though if you look at it objectively, for him to go only from 84 to 81, know, he survived that pretty well. It's like a mob boss getting a guilty verdict and he only gets 3 days in prison or something. Yeah, he could have been docked a lot more, and he probably should have been. But Sneed is not happy. And he has his friend Jack Vardaman, who's a lawyer, very interesting guy himself, Harvard educated, played golf with Sneed, who told Livesey that, quote, "Sam complained forever about the tour taking away the tournaments." He went on to say it always gnawed at him. And what Vardaman explained is that Sneed, you know, didn't win the Grand Slam for his career. He always lacked the U.S. Open. He didn't win 11 in a row like Byron Nelson had. So his legacy was always going to be these total wins. And it was very important to him. So in 1996, Vardaman, it's hard to tell if he just did this of his own volition or if he was spurred on by Sneed. But, you know, Vardaman, by the way, is not just a big-time lawyer who has argued in front of the Supreme Court. He was general counsel for the USGA. He was a very good amateur golfer who won tournaments himself. So this is not outside of his area of expertise at all. But in 1996, he actually writes to Tim Fincham, who is now the tour commissioner, making the argument that Sneed should get 89 wins. He should get all those Greenbriars back and a handful of others that they took away. He identifies those eight tournaments. Now, he doesn't say anything about the four ball or the West Virginia or any of those. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't necessarily draw those to attention. He's focusing on those eight. And he has a point in every case. The problem is he's arguing for a standard that if the tour followed it to the letter, Sneed would lose a lot more than he would gain. And here's the upshot of how that went per Livesey. He says, quote, "Fincham, who received the 1996 letter from Vardaman, had his staff again examine the record and chose not to make any of the changes Vardaman requested. It's always difficult to compare different generations, whether it's tournaments or players," Fincham said. "With the data we had, we did what we thought was fair and reasoned, understanding how different professional golf has been over the years." End quote. I think at your most generous, you give Sneed his Greenbrier wins. This, again, this is at your most generous. A single North and South championship that they took from him. There was some kind of feud one year that cost him one of his wins. It was a fight between the PGA of America and Pinehurst. So maybe give him the Greenbriars, that one, maybe two to three more. But then you're going to have to dock him about 15. There is no re-examination here, no matter how generous, that benefits Sneed. At best, at absolute best, he's hovering in the mid to low 70s. So Fincham gets this letter from Vardaman. He says, "No, we're not changing anything." But maybe an accidental effect of this is that by going on offense, Sneed and Vardaman have ensured that the tour is not going to come back and take any away from them, even though they probably should, in my opinion. Even as recently as 2019, Jay Monahan said this. He said, quote, "It's challenging to evaluate players' careers coming from two separate eras of our history. I know my predecessors care deeply about the game and were guardians of PGA Tour golf. I am confident that they made the best possible decisions based on available information, and I trust their judgment," end quote. In other words, I don't think there's any push from inside the PGA Tour to change the historical record. After Livesey's article came out, Tiger won the Zozo Championship. He tied Sneed at 82, and here we are in a historical deadlock, or you might call it a stalemate, that is either egregious or kind of funny, depending on your perspective and how big a problem you think this is. But where I'd like to leave this is to say that when it comes to Tiger Woods, there is no ambiguity about his total. The official wins are all deserved. The wins that are not up to that standard are not counted. And he can sit comfortably on 82, even if he never wins again. And it goes without saying that if you applied the Sneed standard to Tiger, you'd have almost 100 wins. It's not the case for Sneed. And this seems like it would be a hard project to undertake to do it right, to correct the record. But if there is some value in getting history right, and if we have the power to do so, even in the relatively not so critical realm of golf tournaments and records, we should seize that power because it's in service of the truth. And if there's a way to enshrine that truth in the historical record and to correct the errors of the past, it's hard for me to imagine an argument for doing nothing. Local Knowledge is produced by Greg Gottfried with editorial guidance from Sam Weinman. Our music for today's episode is called The Wanderer by Lobo Loco. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts and check out Golf Digest's other podcasts, The Loop and Golf IQ. If you're a Golf Digest Plus subscriber, try out our new exclusive newsletters. We have Low Net, Golf IQ, and Undercover Pro. Thanks very much and have a great day.